Well, there is a new unstoppable movement that's fixing almost everything wrong with America's healthcare. It's called direct care, and by sidestepping entrenched extractive middles, employers and consumers alike can eliminate all the built-in confusion, gaming, all the tyranny. Because direct care pays for itself, so the members and white coats are doubling every 3 years. Welcome to the new healthcare economy, where everyone wins.
Redirect Health. I chose Redirect Health as our sponsor for a few reasons. I'm a happy client 5 years now, and our most downloaded shows by far are Redirect Health shows. No one has a health plan for small employers more focused on reducing healthcare costs than Redirect Health. They have over 3,000 Google 5-star ratings and growing daily, and they average 4.6 stars overall. So stay tuned for your free report at the end of this show. Business Owner's Guide to Slashing Healthcare Premiums. get.redirecthealth.com/Ron.
And now to the show.
I've pulled together a story from a previous show with Travis Christofferson, who wrote Curable. And it's a story about Catherine Duff, and it starts out in World War II when the Germans were in Rommel's Africa Corps in far North Africa, and all the Germans there were getting dysentery. Today we call it C. diff, we know what it is. And it was wrecking and threatening the whole European operation because they were getting their oil from Libya and Egypt. And it was central to the whole Nazi strategy. But the locals in North Africa were not getting sick at all. The Nazis flew in microbiologists and scientists and doctors, and nobody knew why this mystery couldn't be solved until they started following around some of the Bedouins. And they noticed the strangest thing, that when a camel would poop, the Bedouins would immediately eat the poop, and they've been doing this for centuries. So these camel owners never got sick from C. diff. They isolated the Bacillus subtilis as the active agent, and they would now mix that in a more palatable sterile poop shake, and some of the men drank it, and some of them when they were administered enemas. But today, we call it a fecal matter transplant, or an FMT. And in clinical trials, it had 94% effectiveness combating C. diff. Antibiotics are 75% effective on the front line, and then they drop way off after the front line, and they can wreck you over time if you keep taking them. Not poop shakes. They have no side effects, and you can take them over and over again. So C. diff had nearly killed Catherine Duff, the heroine of this story. And I'll quote her. "For years, I spent lying in bed without the energy to do anything, feeling my life slipping away and being helpless to alter the outcome. And at the beginnings, I started reaching this surreal point where I realized I wasn't sure if I cared anymore. I was just too tired and sick of living or not living, and I actually didn't even care either way. But then she heard about these poop shake enemas. She had to get treated, though, underground, because poop shake enemas were not the gold standard of care. FMT wasn't even a word," says Catherine Duff. "Within 24 hours, all her symptoms disappeared, and 2 weeks later, there was no C. diff indicated, no toxins at all indicated in her bloodstream." So she knocked it out. She shows up at this conference of 150 docs in 2013. They're about to refer this FMT technique with its 94% success to 10 years of investigative trials. And this little tiny lady from Carmel, Indiana, gets to the microphone and she says, "I know y'all, I'm the only member of the public here. The rest of y'all are doctors and scientists and researchers and academics. But just before you vote on this, I've got to tell you my story." And she said, "Why would you delay this 10 years? She knew what they were doing was they were condemning 600 people a week to death from C. diff, not to mention 9,600 weekly getting the infection, which can result not only in colitis, but long-term disabilities like hers. From the antibiotic treatment bumps, even worse outcomes. And that's just C. diff. We're not even talking about MRSA or sepsis, which is now the number three cause of death we now know. And most of these are hospital acquired." Back to her story. She wanted to cry, and she held up 47 pounds of documents supporting the long history of these FMT, these poop shakes. 94% success rate, centuries of Arab and Bedouin success. Where are your souls? What about your Hippocratic oath to do no harm? approved this today. I'm tired of hiding. I'm going to quote her now. Go forward. Be bold. Be courageous. Find a way to quickly, without several years of preclinical and clinical trials, allow qualified doctors to perform FMT with tested donors and signed consents without fear of regulatory consequences. If it was your spouse, your child, your parent, your sibling, or your best friend, and they were dying from antibiotic-resistant C. diff, I imagine you'd want them to be able to try FMT. Please do something, not only for me, but for all of those around the country who have no voice, no insurance, no financial resources, and no hope. Please do something and do it quickly. Thank you. Well, she got a standing ovation, and they did something. And on May 12, 2013, they approved this on a fast track. She is currently the founder of Fecal Transplant Foundation, and it's sort of the standard of care today, or it should be. So this Catherine Duff, this C. diff story, illustrates the power of the patient. Our guest today's favorite subject. You're going to have two links in the show notes that are going to tell you a little more about this if you're interested. Okay, we welcome Dave DeBronkart to our show. And at 56 years old, he was found to have stage 4 cancer. Today he's 70. Now, our guest got a grim prognosis after a routine shoulder scan, luckily indicating an alarming lung mass, which turned out to be later stage 4 kidney cancer. That's 14 years ago. I'm going to let Dave tell the rest of his story of hope and patient empowerment, but you may also have seen his standing ovation TED Talk on patient rights and patient empowerment with its 700,000 views. Now, less than 5% of TED Talkers get a standing O, and maybe 1% get a rousing immediate standing O like he got from everybody. Well, these are our world's greatest speakers and greatest ideas. So Dave is already rare two ways now, you now know. He's a stage 4 survivor, and on stage, he's a brilliant speaker, hundreds of times. But there's more. He's been a visiting professor in internal medicine at Mayo. He's been on the Health Leaders 20 People Who Make Healthcare Better list. And he's a top spokesman for not only patient experience and satisfaction and engagement, but how to disrupt healthcare. He's known as ePatient Dave, and he'll explain what the E is because it's a long list of words. And he's an international keynote and academic lecturer. And he consistently earns extraordinary ratings everywhere he goes, as you can imagine. You'll hear once you listen to him. In addition to hundreds of conferences, speeches, policy conferences, and corporate events, I agree, he thinks the future of his lectures are going to be really academic. And that's the real new frontier for social movement, transforming the role of the patient at the center stage of care. I couldn't agree more. Dave, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Could I get you to repeat some of that to my wife? That's...
I charge for that. That's extra.
I'm kind of mundane and ordinary and everyday around here.
Well, you're a pretty special guy. But do you have any comments before we get going?
Well, you know, it's funny because some people, when they hear about patient empowerment, what comes to mind for because of whatever bad experiences they've had, is patients over or against doctors. So some patients think that being empowered is to resist a physician. And I'm here to tell you that what this is about, from my experience, is about helping healthcare achieve its potential. And that cannot happen unless both people in the relationship are operating at the best possible level. You mentioned Health Leaders naming me to the 20 people who make healthcare better. Along next to me in that listing was my PCP, the famous Dr. Danny Sands at Beth Israel Deaconess in Boston. And we were both talking about and exemplifying what we call participatory medicine. Now, academics like long terms, like participatory. I don't. That at the end of my TED talk, as you know, the chant that I got people saying was not, we demand participatory medicine. It was, let patients help. Right. And that's what this is about. This is about understanding that someone like me with no medical training, I don't even have a master's degree in anything, just a bachelor's. And for heaven's sake, that was in managerial psychology, right? Mm. My being an active partner in my cancer case way back then actually helped me survive as a supplement to what the oncologists were doing. So you just, you ask a simple question, Ron, and I guess to be a passionate keynote speaker, it helps to be able to go off on a 20-minute rant in response to a simple question, but I'll hand it back to you.
Well, I've got so many questions. I don't even know where to start, but you asked me, what are we going to talk about? And I said, I don't know until we get going, but let's start with this one. What did you do so we can give people hope that have kidney cancer, stage four kidney cancer? What did you do specifically that got you back to good health again? Because that, I think just the details of that could be 10 shows of having nothing but stage four cancer survivors on this show. I've talked to one, two, three in my life, all who have incredibly interesting stories. Can we hear your story?
Well, certainly. I want to make clear that being an empowered patient is not a miracle cure. I just finished, there was an incredible woman named Casey Quinlan, nicknamed on social media Mighty Casey, who was as empowered as you get. And she died in April. Her obituary in the BMJ, the British Medical Journal, just went live today. The point here is not that acting a certain way guarantees anything. The point, as I said, is that if a patient can be an empowered partner in partnership with their professional team, then the potential of everything raises. In my case, as you said, as you shared, late in 2006, I had a routine annual physical. And a few days later, I had a sore shoulder. So I got a shoulder x-ray. And a few days later, my PCP called and said, Dave, you know, the radiologist called me. And I pulled up the image on my screen. Now, here's technology. Back then, I couldn't screen share to see what he was looking at. So things have moved forward in that sense. Today, I even have all my images in my computer so I can review them. But he said, your shoulder's going to be fine. It's your sore shoulder. But by dumb luck coincidence, it turned out that that shoulder x-ray had spotted a shadow in the lung tissue near that shoulder. And subsequent scans and tests quickly identified it as being a tumor of kidney cancer. So it was already advanced enough that it had spread to my lung. In fact, we soon discovered there were five tumors in both lungs. I had one bone met growing in my left femur, had one in my skull. And a few weeks before my treatment started, a tumor erupted out of my tongue in my mouth. Now, as I'm sure you know, only the most aggressive cancers grow in muscle tissue. And the best available data at diagnosis said my median survival was 24 weeks. Now, I know enough about statistics. I don't work as a scientist, but I knew enough about statistics to know that the median, and this is one of the first things that a patient can learn about hope and having a reason to take action. The median is not, even though people talk about your prognosis is 24 weeks, the median is not everything. That's half the people in a particular study died. And it says nothing about how long the rest of the people live. So there's a reason to get in action. And a really important moment, and this underscores the participatory medicine lesson, really important moment was when my PCP, Dr. Sands, said, Dave, I know you're an online kind of guy. Now, that, by the way, that's a reason that I hate any insurance company or policy people who think doctors are interchangeable parts. He knew me. He knew what kind of guy I was. And he said, you might like to join this patient community that is good. So notice he didn't say stay off the internet. He showed me where to find the good stuff. So I joined up, and there I've given entire speeches about the things I learned from the patient community. Every word of advice I got there, my oncology team agreed was valid. I did all of that without taking up any more of the doctor's time. They also had all kinds of soul-soothing and practical advice that has nothing to do with RCTs or clinical evidence. And in partnership with them, here's what I learned just to wrap this up. They said, welcome to the club that nobody wants to belong to. We've all been there. Mm-hmm. Now, that's important practically, because I'd never known anybody who had kidney cancer.
Yeah.
They said there is no sure cure for this disease. There's only, and this was years ago, today there are many more treatments. They said there's only one thing that sometimes works, high-dose interleukin-2. It usually doesn't work. It usually goes right through you like water. But if it has any effect at all, there's the good news and the bad news. Half the time, it's complete and permanent. Voila, here I am. Hmm. But 4% of patients die from the side effects. Now, I thought, well, I'm game. And to cut to the chase, when the time came to start the treatment, I said to the oncologist, how do I prepare to deal with these side effects? He said, that's an interesting question. Nobody has ever asked us that. Now, I want to spotlight this moment, because this is where empowerment, that's the biggest E of E patient, comes in. A disempowered person, whether it's a doctor, a physician, a driver on the highway, I don't know, a disempowered person says, oh, there's nothing I can do about this. You can hear that, right? I have no power. An empowered person looks around and says, crap, what can I do about this? I said I might die from the side effects, so what can I do to prepare? And even at one of the best kidney cancer care centers in the world, they had never been asked that question. So I turned then, you notice I didn't reject the medical professionals. I turned then, I asked them first, but then I turned to the patient group. And I said, you who've been through this treatment, what was it like? How did you survive? And I got 16 firsthand stories from people who'd been through it. Now, Ron, there was no guarantee that this was going to save my life, but it tilted the odds a little more in my favor. And when every one of those nasty side effects hit, number one, I knew what was happening. The first example was this thing called Rigor's, where you start this uncontrollable shaking. Some doctors think don't scare the patients by telling them about stuff that might not happen. Right. And of course, that's exactly what you do with a 2-year-old who couldn't understand anyway. You don't get them. Anyway, when Rigor's hit, they said, you're going to start shaking uncontrollably. You call the nurses, they bring warm blankets, they cover you up. You keep shivering for 30 minutes and then it's over. I started shaking. I called the nurses, they brought warm blankets. I had a sense that I was not riding the tail of some horrible dragon. And the punchline is, this stuff, IL-2, because it's so difficult, it's not used very much anymore. But when it works, it's like, bang, baby. I started the treatment in April and it ended in July. I haven't had a drop of anything since. And the real punchline here is that a few years later, when the BMJ asked me to publish my story, because they thought the medical world needed to learn about that patient communities can be valuable. I asked my oncologist, what would you want other doctors to know about my case? And what he said surprised me. He said, you were really sick. And we can put a link to this in the show notes. It's in the BMJ. You were really sick, and I don't know if you could have tolerated enough medicine if you hadn't been so prepared.
Hmm. Now, what a story.
Well, who am I? You know what my medical background is? I worked in the graphic arts.
Okay.
But that's kind of the point. A guy with no medical training, if he does what he can and thinks, can help the doctors have better outcomes.
Well, but see, there's the story right there. Now, we could have nothing but podcasts about stage 4 survivors if we could give them the courage to tell the story like you just did. Most do not have the courage, or their memory has faded, or their brain has been affected by the medication treatments. But that is one great story. All right. Well, let's talk about another subject. I didn't realize I was an E patient until I started preparing for this the last few days. I went to go see my doctor yesterday. They didn't have a blood profile ordered. I had him order one because LabCorp was right upstairs. Went and got the work done, and he suggested six different panels. And I said, here's the seventh one I'd really like, because I understand that's going to be valuable to me. He goes, I left that out. That's a good catch. I went and got the lab done. They're going to be delivered today. He'll call me in a week and we'll talk about if there's anything anomalous or abnormal that we need to discuss. I don't think there will be, but, and I start off the discussion, and this kind of gets back to DPC, which you know is my passion, but because I said, I'm starting off the day, I want you to know, I know what I'm talking about. I'm very comfortable with this meeting. I don't want to have 8 minutes with you. I'd like to have like an hour if I need it. And he mm-hmm. said, well, why would I do that? And I said, because I'm your most profitable patient today. We're paying you cash. Your rate is 250. Most doctors get 70. We're paying you 250 today because that's what you asked for. And you don't have to bill or collect that. It's actually in your account as we speak. So you don't even have to code for this meeting today. I said, but I know you will, because that's just a habit. But I'd like to discuss, you know, this subject and that subject. And we went on about a 30-minute discussion. So I took control of my own power, and I knew what he was getting paid with all the other visits versus mine. He was getting 18% of $250. So with me, he was getting 100%, basically. So, you know, I think about that and I go, I didn't even realize I was an empowered patient by just taking control of the subjects, right? And I jumped right in there and I asked the right questions. And I didn't actually know about you in that much detail yesterday. I learned a lot last night and today.
Yes, absolutely, Ron. And thank you for recognizing that. In my rant a minute ago, I never got around to explaining what e-patient means. After my cancer year in 2007, it's like I thought I was going to be dead. You know, I had updated my will. I was and everything. And then all of a sudden, they say, go out and play. So I started a blog because I didn't have anything else to do with my time. And then Dr. Sands told me about this e-patient stuff that he'd been a pioneer on all the way back into the in the 1990s. And I met the people who were in that team. One of them was this, and the guy who started it all, this doctor named Tom Ferguson, Doc Tom, as he's affectionately known, was just a super visionary. And he was all about doctors and patients achieving the life that people want, the healthy life that people want. He published a magazine and then a book called Medical Self-Care, all kinds of things. So I thought, cool, I'll take on, I had been blogging as Patient Dave. Now I thought I'll just change it to ePatient Dave. I was not famous at the time, far from it. And I just thought it would be an internet nickname like Cowboy Bob or something. And then this pivotal thing happened. By the way, Ferguson said e-patient is to patient as email is to mail, right? The electronic computer-enabled version of the same. And then he made up other things like the E stands for empowered, engaged, equipped, enabled, expert, whatever you want to say. Through the hundreds, you know, I was so thrilled to have the opportunity to, and we need to get back to how I got thrust into the spotlight, but I was so thrilled to have the opportunity to speak to and with thousands and thousands of doctors around the world, because it's been like 600 events in 26 countries. So important for people to understand. To me, number one, a doctor is somebody who did better than me in school. All right. I remember very well in college when I was a party animal back in the 1960s and 70s, there were people we called grade grubbing pre-meds who were working their buns off, working later and longer and harder than me. They passed tests I didn't. And they, every one of them, including you, made a decision at some point in life, I could go into medicine. Right. I could use these good grades, these intellectual skills. I could go into medicine. And my life, you know, when the poop shake hit the fan, right, my life was saved by these people, and including extremely skilled nurses and nurse practitioners as well. And to be able to think how to express to them, let's rethink the relationship, because what I really want to see is for doctors and patients and nurses to be able to do healthcare better. So I, late in 2008, I realized, now mind you, this was before a huge number of people were talking about the crushing financial machinery of medicine, some were, but I realized the system was set up to just keep growing and growing. And I'd done work earlier in my career at understanding system design and the feedback loops and system dynamics. And I knew that the system was never going to, and I'm talking particularly about the American system, was never going to be inclined on its own to become re-optimized toward what you and I need, because the investors and the board of directors were going to be sitting there saying basically, sorry, dude, but our investors need more ROI. So we're going to take the money and we'll give you what's left over. And this pisses me off. It is so dysfunctional. It is, even if there are no corrupt individuals, the design of the system rips the money out of the both the provider of the necessary service and the recipient of it.
Yes. So, Dave, let's get back to your original point. You found yourself on the front page of, was it the Boston Globe due to one of your blogs? What, tell us that story.
So this was, people have said that if what happened to me was a Hollywood movie script, everyone would watch it and laugh and say, yeah, but this only happens in movies. I'm not kidding. So here's thread one of the plot. Dave's coming along. He almost died. He didn't. He's having a good time in 2008. And then he realizes that the system is, I'm thinking, how can I help improve healthcare? I realize the system is not going to do that on its own. So if I want the best possible care, I blogged late in 2008, we are going to have to take control of our medical records so that we're able to self-manage, you know, while the system and the hospital and the insurance people and everybody are off debating money, we're going to need to be able to keep in control of our message, our information. And then along comes a thing called Google Health, which said they were going to be like Quicken or Mint for money, except it was going to be for our medical records. They said, leave things to us. We'll go around and gather your information from the hospital and the doctors and put it together in a nice, pretty dashboard for you. And as it happened, my hospital was the first one to say, hey, we've got a working interface. So I went and clicked the button, and what came across to my screen was garbage. It gave me a false medication warning, because it turns out the information that came across had no dates on it. So it thought, the stupid software thought, that a medicine I was taking now would conflict with my kidney cancer medicine. What a bunch of stupidity. Mm-hmm. And then I noticed that there were diseases in my medical record at my hospital that I had never had. And it turns out that this was because of upcoding or, you know, overcoding. When they billed the insurance company, they jacked up what was actually in the chart so that they could charge a higher amount of money. But there it is. My insurance billing history says I have an aortic aneurysm. I do not. Mm-hmm. And this was the dawning of like, OMG, these computers are insane because they're optimized for the money. Mm-hmm. And there was a 3,000 word blog post I wrote on the night of March 30th, 2009. And yes, I remember that because, man, my life changed all of a sudden. I couldn't get a straight answer out of the hospital. Like, why did you tell Google Health all this stupid stuff? And that it was, believe it or not, the CIO actually said, 5,000 other patients have clicked the link and nobody else has complained. And I just wanted to set my hair on fire. So that's it. You know, I asked nicely three times and then I went to the blog. And on social media, that exploded. But then 3 days later, the Boston Globe called And I can imagine this is the movie scene, right? The blogger sitting there in his recliner writes a blog post, and the phone rings, and it's the newspaper calling. And they didn't just write about it; they put it on page one. So here's, you can see the newspaper front page spinning out of the movie screen. And then I ended up in Washington testifying at policy meetings, because you know what else happened? This is the convergence in the movie script. What else was happening in the spring of 2009? This guy named Obama had just been elected president, and the economic recovery, recovering from what the bankers did to us, the Economic Recovery Act included $40 billion for implementation of electronic medical records. And part of the discussion was whether patients should be able to look at their records. I had no idea any of this was going on. And I literally, at the first policy meeting I sat at in Washington, there was this big horseshoe-shaped table of microphones. And I literally said, I feel a little bit like Reese Witherspoon in Legally Blonde here. You know, I'm really not sure how I got here. I don't have a chihuahua in my pocket. Anyway, that's how me blogging about garbage in my medical record at just the right moment in time ended up in Washington. And earlier on in my career, I had worked in marketing, sales and marketing. I learned how to give good focused speeches that were tuned for every individual audience. You know, so when I speak to functional medicine doctors, it's a different speech from when I talk to health IT people or Europeans with social medicine programs and so on.
Well, Dave, I tried doing what you did. Seven of us got together that are CEOs of different companies. We hired a brilliant Indian doctor and said, unite the clans. We want to get all our medical records under one tent. And he had to go to, in some cases, to 8 or 9 or 10 silos like he did with me. Yep. And in some cases, he went to 2 or 3 silos. Now, I'm telling you, Dave, I'm healthy for 64 years old. I'm on no medications except for one I use for sexual function, but I don't have any others prescribed. I've been prescribed 3 different medications because I've lost a bunch of weight. Bottom line is, he could not get the records for me or the other 6 people because it was too complicated an ask to go to all these different places and get the information. He just couldn't do it. We paid him. He gave us all our money back because he said, I not only failed, but I failed miserably. We signed all the consent forms, but to put on all your records in one silo, and you had a lot deeper files than we have, is for a consumer, I'm going to just say an impossible task, okay? It's just an impossible task. If you're a professional and you say, well, I'm going to have an e-solution, I'm a startup, I'm going to have an e-solution and get everybody under one tent, I just wish them the best of luck, really. I do. I hope somebody can figure this thing out. But our guy could not figure it out, and he's top of his class in a medical school in India.
Sure. Sing it, brother. Absolutely. Absolutely. I don't know if you're in your research before we got together, you know, the first slogan I was known for was Let Patients Help, which also became the title of my tiny book on, you know, 10 Things You Need to Know. But the second one that also came up, first time I was invited to give a keynote speech was in the fall of 2009, that same year. I had never been hired to do a keynote speech. And so when the conference organizer kept saying, Dave, we need to know what's going to be the title of your speech for the brochure, at the third time he asked me, I remember saying into the telephone, I don't know, just call it, give me my damn data.
Well, that'll get people to the talk.
Well, hey, that's it. So there's a 3-minute rock video, a doctor with a garage band produced it.
Well, that's hilarous. So, Dave, the first time I learned about patient empowerment, I didn't know those words even were made into anything. But Dad, 25 years ago in 2 months, was dying of colon cancer. He was at the final stages, and he was getting skinnier and skinnier on this IV drip. And I asked the lead, the attending, why won't we give him food? Is there a reason? He said, no, we could have given him food 4 days ago. And I'm going, Jesus, for God's sakes, give him some food. Get him whatever. Is it Jell-O? Can he eat anything? No, he can eat anything but these 6 or 7 foods. You know, can't have roughage, but he can have everything else. Why not? So Dad was like, he perked up. He's like, are you kidding me? I want this. And he, like a prisoner on his dying day, he ordered everything. So
yep,
he
yep,
was,
yep.
He, I learned then, help the patient who's got someone sick in the hospital now, a child or a husband or a father. Would your book help them know what questions to ask the attending and the dietitian and the attending nurses so that they can have a better care at the hospital?
No, maybe I ought to write that, or at least collect the names of other books that do. My book is just at a very simple level. It was written more than 10 years ago, and it was debunking the idea that patients should sit down and shut up and do as they're told and not ask questions. So I had doctors, for instance, come up and say, well, my patients don't know anything, so why should I show them information? And so there's a line in the book that says, it's perverse to keep people in the dark and then call them ignorant.
There are some hostility feelings out there by primary care doctors. Their patients don't know anything. They're not going to do anything anywhere. If they just stop eating so much, their whole life would change.
Yes.
And it's not that easy with these sugary, salty, fatty diets and processed foods. I mean, they're like crack, But there's some patients, as you said at the top of the show, who also disrespect their doctor. Well, he's just in it for the money and he's, making a living off of me. But you're saying find a doctor who that's not the case with, right?
Exactly. So one practical tip in the book, it's what I call the magic incantation. When I meet a new specialist, right, I start by, it's just level setting like any other business relationship. I say, I'm the kind of patient who likes to understand as much as I can. Could I ask some questions? So when I ask a question, that makes it clear I don't think I know more than the doctor does, right? And I'm very clear, by the way, as the pandemic showed us, no matter how much I like patient empowerment, there are idiots out there. And I do not assert that any patient has any right to say, think, do, and request anything they want. I am only about both parties trying to do a better job and being allowed to do a better job. That's why I hate when insurance gets in the middle, that all this garbage about automated pre-authorization rejections. That don't get me started.
Doesn't exist in DPC. No prior or pre-auth.
Disintermediation, absolutely. I'm well aware.
So the beauty of our movement, and I've got to always mention this in every show, is we have 23 to 25 million members. And this comes from the CEOs who have been on my show. I haven't had them all, but I think I've had most of the big ones. And in addition, we know that 31% of those 25 million get it for free, which means we now have 8 million Americans getting free healthcare. Now, if you're a diversity or inclusion officer or equity officer, you're going to be real excited about 8 million getting free healthcare, because they come from every class, race, color, from the dock workers all the way up to the CEOs of these companies. That's 8 million people. In fact, it was just in the news this week, Dave, that the Las Vegas schools just added 10,000 of their employees of the 40 to free healthcare. So this TPC thing is really not getting any headlines, any news, any academic studies. Yet we have 8 million Americans with free healthcare. And I'll bet you not one of those places have had a strike or a labor union upset, because what do you get better than free healthcare, right?
And I, years into this activism on my part, I found I was wanting to have, because, I don't work as a scientist, but I am a college graduate. I like to have reasons for what I think. And so I started looking for, what do we really mean by empowerment? And I found a fabulous definition. And the thing is, you can hear this as being valid for physicians as well as patients. Okay. I'll give you the definition and then where I got it. Empowerment is increasing people's ability to decide what they want and convert those wants into actions and outcomes, all right, which we also call agency, all right? So when somebody is blocked from taking action toward what they want, whether it's a patient or a doctor, they are disempowered. And whatever is getting in the way of that is cutting back on potential and ought to be ripped out at the roots.
I'm going to refer to two guests that we've had, Frank Dumont with Virta Health and Gene Teschler with a company that got defunded. But they both have figured out that if you empower the patient, you can actually reduce A1C for the majority of the cohort in a study, and I'm talking about 5-year clinical trials,
yeah,
they'll be prescribed. They'll do the right thing. Just tell me how to substitute rice for cauliflower rice. Teach me, you know, how to enjoy the foods I enjoy. But I just want to know, like, what do I need to do with my steps today? What do I need to do with my sleep habits and my hygiene? What it's the patients are eager to get the right answers, but they just need to be told with intelligence, not prescribed. Or this whole idea of patient monitoring. You monitor prisoners with ankle bracelets. Oh. You don't have to monitor patients. They'll step on the scale. They'll send their recording, their data in from their devices they wear on their wrist. They'll send it in. It's automatic, but people want to get better. They just need to know, what do I do next? What's the next step?
I was pre-diabetic and I'm not anymore. I reversed it.
Same here. I was exactly, that's what scared me. Yeah, it scared the heck out of me. So when you start feeling neuropathy and your legs start tingling because you're, 270 instead of what I am today, you wake up real fast.
This is really enjoyable. Thanks, Ron.
This has been a great interview.
I never dropped the punchline. That definition of empowerment is from the World Bank. It's what they developed after decades of going into undeveloped countries and teaching them how to grow an economy and become self-governing and so on. And that's it. It's a fundamental sociological thing. Dag nabbit, we could use more of that in healthcare.
Dave, we're going to do this again because there's so much more to talk about. We only got halfway through the questions, but I enjoyed this so much. We've already gone way over your time, and I appreciate and respect
your time.
That's
okay. Yeah. Any advocate loves a megaphone.
Well, you got one here, hopefully. So how do people reach you, Dave?
My website is epatientdave.com. Having worked in marketing, I'm pretty clear about keeping your branding consistent. Guess what my Twitter handle is?
ePatientDave.
Guess what my handle is on LinkedIn? ePatientDave. And how about Threads, that new Twitter competitor? And there's on the website, there's a contact page with my email address.
Yes, very good. All right. And if you could fly a banner over America, I think I know what it's going to be. But what would your message say to all of America?
Oh boy, am I limited to healthcare?
No, I think it's your chance. I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I think it's your chance.
There'd probably be democracy with an exclamation mark. But even that comes down to people having what they want, right?
Yeah.
And sharing, cooperating. Because democracy is not about overruling somebody, it's about cooperating. So I love it. Collaboration, partnership, let's help each other.
Yes. Dave, thank you for another great talk, except this one's going to be a different kind. I really look forward to our next one. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye now. I have been a happy customer of Redirect Health since before I started the show, guys, and I know firsthand the integrity and laser focus on us of the members of its two founders, Dave Berg and Dr. Janice Johnson. What do I get from me and my team? Well, I have 24/7 access to my healthcare team for any reason, and they have all my medical records right at their fingertips at all times. So no more filling out those stupid forms in clinics. And if I need a refill, if I got a rash, I've hurt my back, I need an annual physical, Redirect Health takes it from there. I just tell them on my app what I need. We get free primary care visits and chiropractic and labs and patient assistance with meds, which means you can get free meds for a lot of your employees, probably most of them actually, and hospitalization with a $2,000 deductible. All of that is in my plan for about half what I used to pay in a traditional high deductible plan. But I have zero deductibles, zero copays, except for that $2,000. So I go to get my care with my own doctor, or they'll find one for me. You keep your doctor with this plan, and I pay nothing there at the clinic after. It's super clean. What a friction-free plan should look like, right? And it's much less chance of any surprise bills, and Redirect totally handles all the hassles when my doctor's billing department in the hospital messes up, and they mess up 80% of the time. Well, I'm treated like a person, not a number at Redirect. So I'll say it on this show a million times and on my LinkedIn post dozens of times, I use Redirect Health. If you want to get the business owner's guide to slashing healthcare premiums, go to get.redirecthealth.com/Ron. get.redirecthealth.com/Ron.
Thanks for listening. You can advance our movement by subscribing, and kindly take a minute and leave a review. Each is a win for this show. Until next episode.